Hello, I'm Bill Sisson, Executive Director of WBCSD North America, and welcome to another podcast of Transformative Leadership in Business. We at WBCSD, with our over 200 companies that we truly believe are the leaders in sustainability, think our role is to provide the how-to elements of critical transformations needed around the climate, nature, and equity imperatives. Learning from these transformational leaders is really vital to understanding the role of business leadership in these outcomes. So today, on that note, I'm joined by Tom Derry, the CEO at the Institute for Supply Management. Thank you for joining me today, Tom.
Bill, it's a real pleasure to be with you. I appreciate the opportunity to cover this really important topic.
Fantastic. And I'm looking forward to really getting into it with you. Today, I think we're going to hear a bit more of the work at ISM. You're the first and largest nonprofit professional supply management organization worldwide. And as we think about how many corporation leaders have embraced their responsibilities these days for delivering on environmental and social issues that ultimately are going to impact their business, the role of procurement professionals in supply chains are critical. Let's put that in perspective today in realizing that just under half the companies in the Russell 1000 have committed to climate disclosure. So as we get started, Tom, I'm sure our listeners would be very interested to hear how you've come to lead this very important organization in regards as a transformational leader. So how about offering a few perspectives on you, maybe your background, and how you've come to land in this fantastic role you're playing at ISM?
I really appreciate it. It's a nice compliment, Bill, but I do feel quite a privileged leader of ISM, especially at this moment in history, economic history, environmental history, geopolitical history. There's so many challenges that we're facing. And for me, it's a blending of things that I've been working on my entire career. I graduated from college in the late 1980s with a degree in international relations. So I've been following geopolitics for 40 plus years, pretty closely. Finally found myself working in sort of the financial world. And so a blending of financial impacts of how companies operate and their performance. Weave these all together by using supply chain as the lens. If there's one major geopolitical development over the last 30 years that really stands out, it's the fall of the Berlin Wall, the launch of the euro in 1999, and the WTO replacing GATT. I mean, there's so many seminal things that have transformed the way we operate on a global basis. The outcome of all of those kinds of individual inputs has been the development of global supply chain, and largely a single extended global supply chain, beginning with the factory floor that is China today for most of the world's economies, and then reaching all regions of the world. We've seen magnificent progress. We've seen the global poverty rate drop from the high 30s to the low single digits during that period, but also not without cost. And more recently, I would say that many individuals and national governments begun to appreciate the implications of this high level of interdependency. And so we're confronting all those kinds of issues, not to mention the generational challenge of climate change, which we're going to get into today, questions around unfair labor practices, tariffs and taxes. It's a very complex environment. So I find it intellectually very challenging and stimulating. And I feel very proud to be asked to lead the organization.
I hear you in background with geopolitical experience and finance experience. I can only imagine how useful those skill sets are being applied today to the challenges facing this global supply chain that we have in play today. Let's unpack a little bit where we're at with this. You know, earlier this year, I had the experience of joining your World Annual Conference and speaking to your exec in session attendees on the implications of sustainability and, in part, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, that is on the path to releasing new disclosure regulation. And a key point being that most companies that are committed to disclosure struggle today with their scope 3, which for your listeners that are unfamiliar with that term, are largely value chain related emissions, and which most companies today account for as much as 70% or higher of their carbon footprint. So can you share your perspectives on how you see these challenges impacting your members going forward?
Yeah, absolutely, Bill. And I think there are a number of vectors, if you will, that are influencing how companies and individuals within companies are organizing themselves to deal with these challenges. So at the highest level, you mentioned the SEC proposed rule. Let's just talk about government disclosure requirements and compliance requirements generally, whether in the United States or in other places around the world. That's the norm. And I think We would suggest that Europe, the European Union in particular, strives to set what becomes the strictest standard, and therefore companies are going to have to comply. And that's one source of motivation, if you will, for doing that. But another very important source of that motivation is frankly from their customer. I remember the case where the Rainforest Action Network was demonstrating on the campus of General Mills outside of Minneapolis, and the company was completely blindsided by that. But, you know, why are these guys here? Well, it had to do with deforestation in places like Indonesia and palm oil production. While General Mills isn't a major purchaser of palm oil for its products, it is a purchaser. And they were being singled out as contributing to a potentially very serious deforestation effort in Indonesia. And in response to that, General Mills changed its sustainable palm oil policy. Finally, just at the leadership level, and ISM research confirms this, at this point in history, all of these sustainability initiatives tend to be top-down driven. That means the board or the CEO typically is involved in establishing the goals, and then it hands off to the team the responsibility for figuring out how's our strategy going to evolve, how are we going to execute to achieve these goals. And more often than not, that's either the chief procurement officer or the chief supply chain officer who gets tasked with determining, okay, we're going to be net carbon zero by a given date. How are we going to get there? Figure it out. And so that's a new set of responsibilities that ISM members are dealing with right now. We first published our principles of corporate social responsibility, including all of these sustainability principles, back in 2004. So we've been doing this a long time. We have been a thought leader in the space, but it's become very real very quickly in the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's very true. What we are learning with our member companies is the degree to which sustainability is being more and more integrated across the functions of the companies. You know, it no longer just resides with that one person who has to collect all the information and report out the corporate responsibility report. It's now become fully integrated. And I think the procurement professionals are certainly in the crosshairs of this transition. Let me take a step back because I got a bit quick into the ESG topic and I missed the front end. We're hearing a lot about supply chain disruptions that are impacting the economy. Can you share with us a bit of your perspectives on what you think are some of the major challenges that are creating these issues for your members today?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. I mean, there's empirical evidence that the incidence of supply chain disruption is significantly higher, and the pandemic exposed the fragility of global supply chains and contributed to the fragility of global supply chains. If you look at supply chain disruptions broadly, whether they're climate related or shortage related or COVID-19 production shutdown related, I mean, there are many, many sources, but in general, they are significantly higher. Climate has played a particular role because we've got more severe weather. In recent history, Winter Storm Uri in Texas had a tremendous impact on the petroleum and resin-based industry in Texas, and had about a 12-month-long impact on supply chains who depend on petroleum-derived chemicals and products. Even though we've never been better prepared and more advanced notice around weather events, they still have a major impact. The zero COVID policy in China today still continues to wreak havoc with global supply chains because it's so unpredictable. And as we're talking today, one of Apple's major suppliers, Foxconn, the facility alone is responsible for $30 billion worth of exports from China every year, one facility. And it's now on lockdown because of an outbreak of COVID. So as long as that policy remains in place, we're going to see these unpredictable but consequential disruptions. I mean, we're not going to get any product out of that factory for weeks or a month. And we're coming up on the U.S. holiday season. Think of the implications for consumers around that. There's just so many factors. And surprisingly, maybe in an unintended way, we've also seen an increase in the number of factory fires around the globe. We trace that back to the pandemic when a priority was placed on figuring out a way to operate and keep production going. Remember, we had a worldwide surge in demand, especially for goods. How are we going to satisfy that demand? We had to keep factories running. Well, it appears that either the safety protocols that were put in place or the necessity to keep demand humming at these high rates lessened the attention that was normally paid to the safety in these plants. And as a result, we're seeing more factory fires. And that puts people's lives and health at risk, but also leads to supply chain disruption. So there are these complex and interrelated factors that have caused supply chain severely disrupted, frankly. Lead times typically in most categories be at least twice what they normally are. If I got a product in 4 weeks, I get it in 8 to 10 weeks. Because supply chains are so tightly integrated and so finely tuned, that kind of a disruption throws off everything. And there's overreaction all throughout the supply chain to that one particular incident. So it exposes some of the ways that we operate as being not flexible and agile enough, frankly, to deal with variation in production.
We tend to, as particularly in the world of ESG, you know, environmental, social, and governance, we tend to think a lot about the environmental implications that might be causing these disruptions. But you took us through some very real social related issues, whether it's COVID or other factors that are also at the helm of causing these disruptions. And maybe just as a follow-up, Tom, I know if you have any thoughts on this, there was a situation in Canada which caused truckers to go on strike as a result of, you know, social unrest around, I think it was vaccinations, that shut down the automotive supply chain for a while.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, they felt discriminated against, I think. They felt like they were singled out by the Canadian government's policy with respect to that particular industry. You know, rightly or wrongly, I'm not going to argue the policy and the politics, but the reality is that we have, and there's frankly a worldwide trucking shortage already. Yeah. So any disruption, remember they blocked the bridge from Detroit to Canada with their trucks for a few days. Any such disruption only exacerbates an already very difficult situation. Many other instances where social elements come to the fore in terms of supply chain.
These are real issues facing business leaders today. That's a core of how they do their business involves people. We're going to have to consider those measures and metrics around how we deal better with some of these issues as part of this agenda going forward, because it's a true and real risk to business. Let me move into another thing I learned at the Exec-In session earlier this year. It seemed that in sort of a very informal poll that I took during the discussion, he sort of raised the question, how many of you are actually starting to see ESG requirements make their way into procurement discussions with your supply chains? And what I gathered from that very informal poll was some were starting to pick up those requirements, but yet were to be executing them. So going back to some of the things we talked about earlier, what you think is really going to be what it's going to take to put greater emphasis and priority on building these requirements into procurement-related exchanges going forward?
We're at a very early stage, I would have to say. The conversations that happen between the large OEMs and the buying companies and their supply base are always a tango. There's reluctance sometimes to be forthcoming and sharing of information. The buyers are certainly aware of imposing further requirements and mandates, as it were, on their supply base. They're sensitive to that. Remember, suppliers tend to be relatively small companies in the scheme of things, and so they don't have the resources that their customers, the big companies, tend to have. So we understand the challenges that are part of that, having that conversation, and yet it's beginning to happen. One interesting dynamic is that if I'm a supplier, let's say, with 6 or 8 production facilities here in the United States, and I brought one online in terms of renewable energy, so one of my plants is now 100% renewable, maybe it's solar powered or wind and solar powered. Well, every one of my customers would love to know which one of those plants it is, right? And would like to get a commitment that I can direct all of my production, all of my buying to that one plant, because they want credit in Scope 3, right, for that renewable energy plant. And the supplier is saying, I can't disclose that necessarily because I can't have 100% of my business routed through one plant. There's a reason I've got 8 plants and I can't accommodate it all in just one plant. So we're in this transition period where people are looking for information. They understand it's the right thing to do. And yet there are practical difficulties that have to be worked through over. I think we'll see it layered in. We mentioned the SEC rule earlier. If that becomes an effective rule, and it could be later this year or early next year, public companies for sure are going to have heightened scrutiny around their climate-related disclosures, including, by the way, in their auditable statements and their audited financial statements. So they're going to have to get real activity from their suppliers to do this. And by the way, it's not that suppliers don't want to cooperate. They see the need themselves. It probably will require a level of cooperation. It will probably require the big companies, the buying companies, committing to investing in their suppliers to build up their capability, to provide the reporting, to make the transition to renewables, to make product substitutions that are more sustainable, whatever it may take, to reduce waste in the production process. We've negotiated such low margins with our suppliers typically that they don't have a lot of additional cash to fund these sorts of transitions. So that we have to recognize that we may have to be a source of some of that funding to help our supply-based transition.
I think you're absolutely right that certainly the regulatory environment is starting to send very strong signals that this is going to become real, real fast. And I think correspondingly, what we talked about earlier, those integrated cross-functional requirements that are starting to come top down are going to become way more legitimized going forward. Let me allow you to flip the story here or script a little bit. Probably some issues that you're sort of picking up on from your members that I might be able to help you with. So perhaps a question from you to me that might get us at that.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Bill, because as the discussion around ESG and sustainability has intensified and become more real, perhaps in a very expected way, there's also been some pushback on the concept. And I would say ISM members are divided. Traditionally, our primary role has been to deliver total lowest costs on behalf of the company. And we are very cost-focused as a profession. And there is a concern that these additional compliance requirements from the government, ESG in general, from our investing community, are going to raise our cost base. Concern that it's not real. What used to be known as CSR is now known as ESG. And a decade from now, we'll have another three-letter acronym. How would you answer the skeptics out there that think this might just be another corporate fad that is, if we hunker down, we'll just get through it?
Yeah, thanks for the question. You know, easy answer, right? I think that there's a lot of propaganda and a propping up of ideologic rhetoric that is just adding a lot of unnecessary noise to the reality that things need to change. There is no question about the science and what's going on with the changing climate, the issue that we're facing on biodiversity, nature loss that's running species out of existence. You're picking up these headlines every day. And it's just going to get worse. And let's face it, the C-suites in the corporate world have realized that these environmental and social issues are already impacting their business today and is going to continue to be an increasing risk to their business and operations going forward. They know they need to take action. So the anti-ESG climate that's out there on some equation is just fodder for the moment. It's going to go away because this is about doing good business. This is business doing good business, full stop. And I think the second skeptical response would be, let's face the reality that today, as I mentioned earlier, half the Russell 1000 are giving way to committed to climate disclosures. And going along with that, one out of every $3 of assets under management in the investment world are tied to an ESG rated fund. This needs market regulation so that it comes to a real, comparable, consistent, and credible data-informed environment that allows investors to have security on how their investments are being managed and realized within these funds. This all has to change. And so this isn't going to go away. I think the adage that the train has left the station has certainly applies here. And I guess finally, as I mentioned, it's really about doing good business to secure and future-proof the value of your company. And these issues are putting tremendous pressure on company leaders today to think about that. And capital markets are asking those questions. Shareholders are asking those questions. Investor relations teams are getting those questions. And then there's this broader class of stakeholders, future employees, new employees, customers, consumers, supply chains like we're talking about. Your upstream customers are going to be increasing their demands for suppliers on this issue as well. This is really a moment where, despite the rhetoric, we see this sort of three-letter, largely misunderstood acronym, ESG, environmental and social efforts of companies being rightfully governed by and within those companies has become a proxy for how well a company is run and how well it's addressing risks for its future performance. And so, like I said, I don't see this going away. And if anything, it's going to accelerate. And those that are practicing old school and buying into some of the ideologic arguments are going to frankly be put out of business going forward if they don't take this seriously. So there's my response, Tom.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Bill, because that's our point of view on the issue at ISM. You know, we've been leaders, I mentioned earlier, in helping develop some thinking around this. We completely agree that when you're talking about affecting the fundamental processes of either capital formation or capital allocation, you know, the fundamental things that drive business as we are, you're at the foundation of what makes our global economy work. So you have to deal with that reality as a company.
That's right.
That's where we are. And, you know, ISM's mission statement contains the very word sustainable. We're committed to seeing the world prosper for sure, but in a sustainable way. And I couldn't agree more that the skepticism is a little misplaced. I get why people might feel that way, but the reality is that history is moving fast here and will overwhelm them.
Absolutely, Tom. I sort of am on record as calling it's true north. There's only one direction that we can go as the world economy, and business has to understand it's part of that. And I think many do. And true north is true north no matter what you do. So anyway, hey, look, this has been great, Tom. It's been great to chat with you about ISM and some of the great work you're doing in that space. Perhaps maybe just a closing question on how the listeners picking up on this discussion today can learn more about ISM resources and how they would gain access.
I mentioned our principles of corporate social responsibility. They're published on the ISM website, which is ismworld.org. It's a great place to go to get some preliminary information. In fact, about 22% of large cap companies use our principles as their framework for sustainability reporting. So it's a good standard for people to refer to as a starting point. And then shoot us an email anytime. We'd be happy to engage and think about attending our conference in May in Dallas and learning more, because this will be a very heavily covered topic, because it has to be.
You've inspired me as being a transformational leader at the head of the Institute for Supply Management. So thank you for your great insights. You're doing great work to try to build out how this community of procurement professionals takes this really important topic forward. And thankfully and hopefully, this has been a very important moment for our listeners to hear about your great work. So thank you again.
Thank you for your global leadership on this topic. The WBCSD is doing amazing work.
Thank you, Tom. Very much appreciate that.